She's been saying, "What if?" to me since she was about 17. I have gotten terribly tired of it over the years.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. Just don't do it any more.
Overhead in the pitch blackness of the blustery sky, there was a sudden ponderous flap, as of enormous wings.
What's that?
Garion asked, startled.
Be still.
Wolf stood, with his face turned upward. There was another great flap.
Oh, that's sad.
What?
I thought the poor old brute had been dead for centuries. Why don't they leave her alone?
What is it?
It doesn't have a name. It's big, stupid, and ugly. The gods only made three of them, and the two males killed each other during the first mating season. She's been alone for as long as I can remember.
It sounds huge,
Garion said, listening to the enormous wings beating overhead as he peered up into the darkness.
What does it look like?
She's as big as a house, and you really would not want to see her.
Is she dangerous?
Yeah, very dangerous. But she can't see too well at night. The Grodoms must have chased her out of her cave and put her to hunting for us. Oh, sometimes they go too far.
Should we tell the others about her?
No, it would only worry them. Sometimes it is better not to say anything.
The great wings flapped again, and there was a long, despairing cry from the darkness. It was a cry filled with such aching loneliness that Garion felt a great surge of pity welling up in him. Wolf sighed again.
There's nothing we can do. Come, let's go back to the tents.
Chapter 8. The weather continued raw and unsettled as they rode for the next 2 days up the long, sloping rise toward the snow-covered summits of the mountains. The trees became sparser, more stunted as they climbed, and finally disappeared entirely. The ridgeline flattened out against the side of one of the mountains, and they rode up into a steep slope of tumbled rock and ice where the wind scoured continually. Mr. Wolf paused to get his bearings, looking around in the pale afternoon light.
That way,
he said finally, pointing back. A saddleback stretched between the two peaks, and the sky beyond roiled in the wind. They rode up the slope, their cloaks pulled tightly about them. Petar came forward with a worried frown on his hawk face.
That pregnant mare is in trouble. I think her time is getting close.
Without a word, Aunt Paul dropped back to look at the mare, and her face was grave when she returned.
She is no more than a few hours away, Father.
Wolf looked around.
There's no shelter on this side.
Maybe there will be something on the other side of the pass,
Barak suggested, his beard whipping in the wind. Wolf shook his head.
I think it's the same as this side. We are going to have to hurry. We don't want to spend the night up here.
As they rode higher, occasional spits of stinging sleet pelted them, and the wind gusted even stronger, howling among the rocks. As they crested the slope and started through the saddle, the full force of the gale struck at them, driving a tattered sleet squall before it.
It's even worse on this side, Belgorath,
Barak shouted over the wind.
How far is it down to the trees?
Miles,
Wolf replied, trying to keep his flying cloak pulled around him.
The mare will never make it,
Petar said.
We have got to find shelter.
There isn't any. Not until we get to the trees. It's all bare rock and ice up here.
Without knowing why he said it, not even aware of it until he spoke, Garion made a shouted suggestion.
What about the cave?
Mr. Wolf turned and looked sharply at him.
What cave? Where?
The one in the side of the mountain. It's not far.
Garion knew the cave was there, but he did not know how he knew.
Are you sure?
Of course. It's this way.
Geryon turned his horse and rode up the slope of the saddle toward the vast craggy peak on the left. The wind tore at them as they rode, and the driving sleet half-blinded them. Geryon moved confidently, however. For some reason, every rock about them seemed absolutely familiar, though he could not have said why. He rode just fast enough to stay in front of the others. He knew they would ask questions, and he didn't have any answers. They rounded a shoulder of the peak and rode out onto a broad rock ledge. The ledge curved along the mountainside, disappearing into a swirling sheet of sleet ahead of them.
"Where art thou taking us, lad?"
Mandor Allan shouted to him.
"It's not much farther,"
Geryon yelled back over his shoulder. The ledge narrowed as it curved around the looming granite face of the mountain. Where it bent around a jutting cornice, it was hardly more than a footpath. Geryon dismounted and led his horse around the cornice. The wind blasted directly into his face as he stepped around the granite outcropping, and he had to put his hand in front of his face to keep the sleet from blinding him. Walking that way, he did not see the door until it was almost within reach of his hands. The door in the face of the rock was made of iron, black and pitted with rust and age. It was broader than the gate at Faldor's farm, and the upper edge of it was lost in the swirling sleet. Barak, following close behind him, reached out and touched the iron door. Then he banged on it with his huge fist. The door echoed hollowly.
"There is a cave,"
he said back over his shoulder to the others.
"I thought that the wind had blown out the boy's senses."
"How do we get inside?"
Hithar shouted, the wind snatching away his words.
"The door's as solid as this mountain itself,"
Beric said, hammering with his fists again.
"We have got to get in out of this wind,"
Aunt Paul declared, one of her arms protectively about Sinedra's shoulders.
"Well, Geryon?" Mr. Wolf asked.
"It's easy," Geryon replied. "I just have to find the right spot."
He ran his fingers over the icy iron, not knowing just what he was looking for. He found a spot that felt a little different.
"Here it is."
He put his right hand on the spot and pushed lightly. With a vast, grating groan, the door began to move. A line that had not even been visible before suddenly appeared like a razor cut down the precise center of the pitted iron surface, and flakes of rust showered from the crack to be whipped away in the wind. Geryon felt a peculiar warmth in the silvery mark on the palm of his right hand where it touched the door. Curious, he stopped pushing. But the door continued to move, swinging open, it seemed, almost in response to the presence of the mark on his palm. It continued to move even after he was no longer touching it. He closed his hand, and the door stopped moving. He opened his hand, and the door, grating against the stone, swung open even wider.
"Don't play with it, dear," Aunt Paul told him. "Just open it."
It was dark in the cave beyond that huge door. It seemed not to have the musty smell that it should have had. They entered cautiously, feeling at the floor carefully with their feet.
"Just a moment," Durnick murmured in a strangely hushed voice.
They heard him unbuckling one of his saddlebags and then heard the rasp of his flint against steel. There were a few sparks, then a faint glow, as the smith blew on his tinder. The tinder flamed, and he set it to the torch he had pulled from his saddlebag. The torch sputtered briefly, then caught. Durnick raised it, and they all looked around at the cave. It was immediately evident that the cave was not natural. The walls and floor were absolutely smooth, almost polished, and the light of Durnick's torch reflected back from the gleaming surfaces. The chamber was perfectly round, and about 100 feet in diameter. The walls curved inward as they rose, and the ceiling high overhead seemed also to be round. In the precise center of the floor stood a round stone table, 20 feet across, with its top higher than Barak's head. A stone bench encircled the table. In the wall, directly opposite the door, was a circular arch of a fireplace. The cave was cool, but it did not seem to have the bitter chill that it should have had.
"Is it all right to bring in the horses?"
Hithar asked quietly. Mr. Wolf nodded. His expression seemed bemused in the flickering torchlight, and his eyes were lost in thought. The horse's hooves clattered sharply on the smooth stone floor as they were led inside, and they looked around, their eyes wide and their ears twitching nervously.
"There's a fire laid in here," Dunnick said from the arched fireplace. "Shall I light it?"
Wolf looked up.
"What? Oh, yes, go ahead."
Dunnick reached into the fireplace with his torch, and the wood caught immediately. The fire swelled up very quickly, and the flames seemed inordinately bright.
Tenedra gasped.
"The walls! Look at the walls!"
The light from the fire was somehow being refracted through the crystalline structure of the rock itself, and the entire dome began to glow with a myriad of shifting colors, filling the chamber with a soft, multi-hued radiance. Hetar had moved around the circle of the wall and was peering into another arched opening.
"A spring. This is a good place to ride out a storm."
Dernick put out his torch and pulled off his cloak. The chamber had become warm almost as soon as he had lighted the fire. He looked at Mr. Wolf.
"You know about this place, don't you?"
"None of us has ever been able to find it before,"
the old man replied, his eyes still thoughtful.
"We weren't even sure that it still existed."
"Oh, what a strange cave this is. Belgarath, what is it?"
Mr. Wolf took a deep breath.
"When the gods were making the world, it was necessary for them to meet from time to time to discuss what each of them had done, and was going to do, so that everything would fit together and work in harmony. The mountains, the winds, the seasons, and so on."
He looked around.
"This is the place where they met."
Silk, his nose twitching with curiosity, had climbed up onto the bench surrounding the huge table.
"There are bowls up here. 7 of them. And 7 cups. There seems to be some kind of fruit in the bowls."
He began to reach out with one hand.
"Silk,"
Mr. Wolf told him sharply.
"Don't touch anything."
Silk's hand froze, and he looked back over his shoulder at the old man, his face startled.
"You'd better come down from there," Wolf said gravely.
"The door!"
Tenedra exclaimed. They all turned in time to see the massive door gently swinging closed. With an oath, Barak leaped toward it, but he was too late. Booming hollowly, it clanged shut just before his hands reached it. The big man turned, his eyes filled with dismay.
"It's all right, Barak. I can open it again,"
Geryon told him. Wolf turned then and looked at Geryon, his eyes questioning.
"How did you know about this cave?"
Geryon floundered helplessly.
"I don't know. I just did. I think I've known we were getting close to it for the last day or so."
"Does it have anything to do with the voice that spoke to Mara?"
"I don't think so. He doesn't seem to be there just now, and my knowing about the cave seemed to be different somehow. I think it came from me, not him, but I'm not sure how. For some reason, it seems that I've always known this place was here, only I didn't think about it until we started to get near it. It's awfully hard to explain it exactly."
Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolf exchanged a long glance. Wolf looked as if he were about to ask another question, but just then there was a groan at the far end of the chamber.
"Somebody, help me,"
Hetar called urgently. One of the horses, her sides distended and her breath coming in short, heaving gasps, stood swaying as if her legs were about to give out from under her. Hetar stood at her side, trying to support her.
"She is about to fall."
They all turned then and went quickly to the laboring mare. Aunt Paul immediately took charge of the situation, giving orders crisply. They eased the mare to the floor, and Hetar and Dernick began to work with her, even as Aunt Paul filled a small pot with water and set it carefully on the fire.
"I'll need some room," she told the rest of them pointedly, as she opened the bag which contained her jars of herbs.
"Why don't we all get out of your way?"
Barak suggested, looking uneasily at the gasping horse.
"Splendid idea," she agreed. "Tenedra, you stay here. I will need your help."
Geryon, Beric, and Mandorallan moved a few yards away and sat down, leaning back against the glowing wall, while Silk and Mr. Wolf went off to explore the rest of the chamber. As he watched Durnik and Hetar with the mare, and Aunt Paul and Tenedra by the fire, Geryon felt strangely abstracted. The cave had drawn him, there was no question of that, and even now it was exerting some peculiar force on him. Though the situation with the mare was immediate, he seemed unable to focus on it. He had a strange certainty that finding the cave was only the first part of whatever it was that was happening. There was something else he had to do, and his abstraction was in some way a preparation for it.
"It is not an easy thing to confess," Mandorallan was saying somberly. Geryon glanced at him. "In view of the desperate nature of our quest, however," the knight continued, "I must openly acknowledge my great failing. It may come to pass that this flaw of mine shall in some hour of great peril cause me to turn and flee like the coward I am, leaving all your lives in mortal danger."
"You're making too much of it."
"Nay, my lord, I urge that you consider the matter closely to determine if I am fit to continue on our enterprise."
He started to creak to his feet.
"Where are you going?"
Beric asked him.
"I thought to go apart, so that you may freely discuss the matter."
"Oh, sit down, Mandorallan. I'm not going to say anything behind your back that I would not say to your face."
The mare, lying close to the fire with her head cradled in Hetar's lap, groaned again.
"Is that medicine almost ready, Balgara?"
the Algar asked in a worried voice.
"Not quite,"
she replied. She turned back to Tenedra, who was carefully grinding up some dried leaves in a small cup with the back of a spoon.
"Break them up a little finer, dear."
Durnik was standing astride the mare, his hands on her distended belly.
"We may have to turn the foal. Oh, I think it's trying to come out wrong way."
"Don't start on that until this has a chance to work,"
Aunt Paul told him, slowly tapping a grayish powder from an earthen jar into her bubbling pot. She took the cup of leaves from Tenedra, and added that as well, stirring as she poured.
"I think, my lord Beric, that thou hast not fully considered the import of what I have told thee."
"I heard you. You said you were afraid once. It is nothing to worry about. It happens to everybody now and then."
"Ah, but I cannot live with it. I live in constant apprehension, never knowing when it will return to unman me."
Durnik looked up from the mare.
"You're afraid? Of being afraid?" he asked in a puzzled voice. "You cannot know what it is like, my good friend," Mandorallan replied. "Your stomach tightened up," Durnik told him. "Your mouth was dry, and your heart felt as if someone had his fist clamped around it, right?"
Mandorallan blinked.
"It's happened to me so often that I know exactly how it feels."
"Thou?
Thou art among the bravest men I have ever known."
Durnik smiled wryly.
"I'm an ordinary man, Mandorallan. Ordinary men live in fear all the time. Didn't you know that? We're afraid of the weather. We're afraid of powerful men. We're afraid of the night and the monsters that lurk in the dark. We're afraid of growing old and of dying. Sometimes we're even afraid of living. Ordinary men are afraid almost every minute of their lives. How can you bear it? Do I have any choice? Fear's a part of life, Mandorallan. And it's the only life we've got. You just have to get used to it. After you've put it on every morning like an old tunic, you won't even notice it anymore. Sometimes laughing at it helps. A little. Laughing? Shows the fear that you know it's there. But that you're going to go ahead and do what you have to do anyway."
Durnik looked down at his hands, carefully kneading the mare's belly.
Some men curse and swear and bluster. Well, that does the same thing, I suppose. Every man has to come up with his own technique for dealing with it. Personally, I prefer laughing. Seems more appropriate somehow.
Mandarallan's face became gravely thoughtful as Durnick's words slowly sank in.
I will consider this. It may be, good friend, that I will owe thee more than my life for thy gentle instruction.
Once more the mare groaned a deep, tearing sound, and Durnick straightened and began rolling up his sleeves.
The foal's going to have to be turned, Mistress Paul, he said decisively, and soon, or we'll lose this foal and the mare both.
Let me get some of this into her first, she replied, quenching her boiling pot with some cold water. Hold her head, she told Hettar. Hettar nodded and firmly wrapped his arms around the laboring mare's head. Geryon, Aunt Paul said, as she spooned the liquid between the mare's teeth. Why don't you and Synedra go over there where Silk and your grandfather are?
Have you ever turned a foal before, Durnick?
Not a foal, but calves many times. Horse isn't that much different from a cow, really.
Barak stood up quickly. His face had a slight greenish cast to it.
I'll go with Geryon and the princess, he rumbled. I don't imagine I'd be much help here.
And I will join thee, Mandarallan declared. His face was also visibly pale. It were best, I think, to leave our friends ample room for their midwifery.
Aunt Paul looked at the two warriors, a slight smile on her face, but said nothing. Geryon and the others moved rather quickly away. Silk and Mr. Wolf were standing beyond the huge stone table, peering into another of the circular openings in the shimmering wall.
I have never seen fruits exactly like those, the little man was saying.
I'd be very surprised if you had, Wolf replied.
They look as fresh as if they had just been picked.
Silk's hand moved almost involuntarily toward the tempting fruit.
I wouldn't, Wolf warned.
I wonder what they taste like.
Wondering won't hurt you. Tasting might.
I hate an unsatisfied curiosity.
You'll get over it.
Wolf turned to Geryon and the others.
How is the horse?
Durnick says he's going to have to turn the foal. We thought it might be better if we all got out of the way.
Wolf nodded.
Silk,
he admonished sharply, not turning around. No, sorry. Silk snatched his hand back.
Why don't you just get away from there? You're only going to get yourself into trouble.
Silk shrugged.
I do that all the time, anyway.
Just do it, Silk,
Wolf told him firmly.
I cannot watch over you every minute.
He slipped his fingers up under the dirty and rather ragged bandage on his arm, scratching irritably.
That is enough of that, he declared. Geryon, take this thing off of me.
He held out his arm. Geryon backed away.
Not me, he refused. Do you know what Aunt Paul would say to me if I did that without her permission?
Don't be silly. Silk, you do it.
First you say to stay out of trouble, and then you tell me to cross Balgara. You are very inconsistent, Belgareth. Oh, here, Synedra said.
She took hold of the old man's arm and began picking at the knotted bandage with her tiny fingers.
Just remember, this was your idea. Geryon, give me your knife.
Somewhat reluctantly, Geryon handed over his dagger. The princess sawed through the bandage and began to unwrap it. The splints fell clattering to the stone floor.
What a dear child you are.
Mr. Wolf beamed at her and began to scratch at his arm with obvious relief.
Just remember that you owe me a favor, she told him.
She is Tonedrin, all right, Silk observed.
It was about an hour later when Aunt Paul came around the table to them, her eyes somber.
"How's the mare?"
Tenedra asked quickly.
"Very weak. But I think she will be all right. And what about the baby horse?"
Aunt Paul sighed.
"We were too late. We tried everything. But we just could not get him to start breathing."
Tenedra gasped, her little face suddenly a deathly white.
"You're not going to just give up, are you?"
She said it almost accusingly.
"There's nothing more we can do, dear,"
Aunt Paul told her sadly.
"It took too long. He just didn't have enough strength left."
Tenedra stared at her unbelieving.
"Do something,"
she demanded.
"You're a sorceress. Do something." "I am sorry, Tenedra. That's beyond our power. We cannot reach beyond that barrier."
The little princess wailed then and began to cry bitterly. Aunt Paul put her arms comfortingly about her and held her as she sobbed. But Geryon was already moving. With absolute clarity, he now knew what it was that the cave expected of him. And he responded without thinking, not running or even hurrying. He walked quietly around the stone table toward the fire. Petar sat cross-legged on the floor with the unmoving colt in his lap, his head bowed with sorrow and his mane-like scalp lock falling across the spindle-shanked little animal's silent face.
"Give him to me, Petar." "Geryon, no!"
Aunt Paul's voice, coming from behind him, was alarmed. Petar looked up, his hawk face filled with deep sadness.
"Let me have him, Petar,"
Geryon repeated very quietly. Wordlessly, Petar raised the limp little body, still wet and glistening in the firelight, and handed it to Geryon. Geryon knelt and laid the foal on the floor in front of the shimmering fire. He put his hands on the tiny rib cage and pushed gently.
"Breathe,"
he almost whispered.
"We tried that, Geryon. We tried everything."
Geryon began to gather his will.
"Don't do that, Geryon," Aunt Paul told him firmly. "It isn't possible. You'll hurt yourself if you try."
Geryon was not listening to her. The cave itself was speaking to him too loudly for him to hear anything else. He focused his every thought on the wet, lifeless body of the foal. Then he stretched out his right hand, laid his palm on that unblemished, walnut-colored shoulder of the small, dead animal. Before him there seemed to be a blank wall, black and higher than anything else in the world, impenetrable, silent, beyond his comprehension. Tentatively he pushed at it, but it would not move. He drew in a deep breath and hurled himself entirely into the struggle.
"Live,"
he said.
"Geryon, stop!"
"Live," he said again, throwing himself deeper into his effort against that blackness.
"It's too late now, Paul,"
he heard Mr. Wolf say from somewhere.
"He has already committed himself."
"Live,"
Geryon repeated, and the surge he felt welling up out of him was so vast that it drained him utterly. The glowing walls flickered, and then suddenly rang, as if a bell had been struck somewhere deep inside the mountain. The sound shimmered, filling the air inside the domed chamber with a vibrant ringing. The light in the walls suddenly flared with a searing brightness, and the chamber was as bright as noon. The little body under Geryon's hand quivered, and the colt drew in a deep, shuddering breath. Geryon heard the others gasp as the stick-like little legs began to twitch. The colt inhaled again, and his eyes opened.
"A miracle,"
Mandarallan said in a choked voice.
"Perhaps even more than that,"
Mr. Wolf replied, his eyes searching Geryon's face. The colt struggled, his head wobbling weakly on his neck. He pulled his legs under him and began to struggle to his feet. Instinctively, he turned to his mother and tottered toward her to nurse.
His coat, which had been a deep, solid brown before Geryon had touched him, was now marked on the shoulder with a single, incandescently white patch, exactly the size of the mark on Geryon's palm. Geryon lurched to his feet and stumbled away, pushing past the others. He staggered to the icy spring bubbling in the opening in the wall and splashed water over his head and neck. He knelt before that spring, shaking, breathing hard, for a very long time. Then he felt a tentative, almost shy touch on his elbow. When he warily raised his head, he saw the now steadier colt standing at his side and gazing at him with adoration in its liquid eyes. Chapter 9. The storm blew itself out the next morning, but they stayed in the cave for another day after the wind had died down to allow the mare to recover and the newborn colt to gain a bit more strength. Geryon found the attention of the little animal disturbing. It seemed that no matter where he went in the cave, those soft eyes followed him, and the colt was continually nuzzling at him. The other horses also watched him with a kind of mute respect. All in all, it was a bit embarrassing. On the morning of their departure, they carefully removed all of the traces of their stay in the cave. The cleaning was spontaneous, neither the result of some suggestion or of any discussion, but rather was something in which they all joined without comment.
"The fire's still burning," Durnick fretted, looking back into the glowing dome from the doorway as they prepared to leave. "It will go out by itself after we leave," Wolf told him. "I don't think you could put it out anyway, no matter how hard you tried."
Durnick nodded soberly.
"You're probably right."
"Close the door, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul said, after they had led their horses out onto the ledge outside of the cave. Somewhat self-consciously, Geryon took hold of the edge of the huge iron door and pulled it. Although Barak, with all of his great strength, had tried, without success, to budge the door, it moved easily as soon as Geryon's hand touched it. A single tug was enough to set it swinging gently closed. The two solid edges came together with a great hollow boom, leaving only a thin, nearly invisible line where they met. Mr. Wolf put his hand lightly on the pitted iron, his eyes far away. Then he sighed once, turned and led them back along the ledge the way they had come 2 days before. Once they had rounded the shoulder of the mountain, they remounted and rode on down through the tumbled boulders and patches of rotten ice to the first low bushes and stunted trees a few miles below the pass. Although the wind was still brisk, the sky overhead was blue, and only a few fleecy clouds raced by, appearing strangely close. Geryon rode up to Mr. Wolf and fell in beside him. His mind was filled with confusion by what had happened in the cave, and he desperately needed to get things straightened out.
"Grandfather?"
"Yes, Geryon," the old man answered, rousing himself from his half-doze.
"Why did Aunt Paul try to stop me? With the colt, I mean."
"Because it was dangerous. Very dangerous."
"Why dangerous?"
"When you try to do something that's impossible, you can pour too much energy into it. And if you keep trying, it can be fatal."
"Fatal?"
Wolf nodded.
"You can drain yourself out completely, and you don't have enough strength left to keep your own heart beating."
"I didn't know that."
Geryon was shocked. Wolf ducked as he rode under a low branch.
Obviously.
"Don't you keep saying that nothing is impossible?"
"Within reason, Geryon. Within reason."
They rode on quietly for a few minutes, the sound of their horses' hooves muffled by the thick moss covering the ground under the trees.
"Maybe I had better find out more about all of this,"
Geryon said finally.
"That's not a bad idea. What was it you wanted to know?"
"Everything, I guess."
Mr. Wolf laughed.
"That would take a very long time, I'm afraid."
Geryon's heart sank.
"Is it that complicated?"
"No, actually it's very simple. But simple things are always the hardest to explain.
That doesn't make any sense, Garion retorted, a bit irritably.
Oh? Wolf looked at him with amusement. Let me ask you a simple question, then. What's 2 and 2?
4, Garion replied promptly.
Why?
Garion floundered for a moment.
It just is, he answered lamely.
But why?
There isn't any why to it, it just is.
There's a why to everything, Garion.
All right. Why is 2 and 2 4, then?
I don't know. I thought maybe you might.
They passed a dead snag standing twisted and starkly white against the deep blue sky.
Are we getting anywhere?
Garion asked, even more confused now.
Actually, I think we have come a very long way,
Wolf replied.
Precisely what was it you wanted to know?
Garion put it as directly as he knew how.
What is sorcery?
I told you that once already. The will and the word.
That doesn't really mean anything, you know.
All right, try it this way. Sorcery is doing things with your mind instead of your hands. Most people don't use it because at first it's much easier to do things the other way.
Garion frowned.
It doesn't seem hard.
That's because the things you have been doing have come out of impulse. You never sat down and thought your way through something. No, you just do it, don't you?
Well, isn't it easier that way? What I mean is, why not just do it and not think about it?
Because spontaneous sorcery is just third-rate magic, completely uncontrolled. Anything can happen if you simply turn the power of your mind loose. It has no morality of its own. The good or the bad of it comes out of you, not out of the sorcery.
You mean when I burned Asherak, it was me and not the sorcery?
Garion asked, feeling a bit sick at the thought. Mr. Wolf nodded gravely.
It might help if you remember that you were also the one who gave life to the colt. The two things sort of balance out.
Garion glanced back over his shoulder at the colt, who was frisking along behind him like a puppy.
What you're saying is that it can't be either good or bad.
No, Wolf corrected. By itself, it has nothing to do with good or bad. And it won't help you in any way to make up your mind how to use it. You can do anything you want to with it. Almost anything, that is. You can bite the tops off all of the mountains or stick the trees in the ground upside down, or turn all of the clouds green if you feel like it. What you have to decide is whether you should do something, not whether you can.
You said almost anything.
I'm getting to that.
Wolf looked thoughtfully at the low-flying cloud above them, an ordinary-looking old man in a rusty tunic and gray hood, looking at the sky.
There's one thing that is absolutely forbidden. You can never destroy anything. Not ever.
Garion was baffled by that.
I destroyed Asherak, didn't I?
No, you killed him. There is a difference. You set fire to him and he burned to death. To destroy something is to try to uncreate it. That is what is forbidden.
What would happen if I did try?
Your power would turn inward on you, and you would be obliterated in an instant.
Garion blinked and then suddenly went cold at the thought of how close he had come to crossing that forbidden line in his encounter with Asherak.
How do I tell the difference?
He asked in a hushed voice.
I mean, how do I go about explaining that I only meant to kill someone and not destroy him?
It's not a good area for experimentation, Wolf told him. If you really want to kill somebody, stick your sword in him. Hopefully, you won't have the occasion to do that sort of thing too often.
They stopped at a small brook trickling out of some mossy stones to allow the horses to drink.
You see, Garion, Wolf explained,
The ultimate purpose of the universe is to create things. It won't permit you to come along behind it, uncreating all of the things it went to so much trouble to create in the first place. When you kill somebody, all you've really done is alter him a bit. You have changed him from being alive to being dead. He's still there. To uncreate him, you have to will him out of existence entirely. When you feel yourself on the verge of telling something to vanish or go away, or be not, you're getting very close to the point of self-destruction. That's the main reason we have to keep our emotions under control all of the time.
I didn't know that.
You do now. Don't even try to unmake a single pebble.
A pebble?
The universe doesn't make any distinction between a pebble and a man. The old man looked at him somewhat sternly. Your aunt has been trying to explain the necessity for keeping yourself under control for several months now, and you have been fighting her every step of the way. Geryon hung his head.
I didn't know what she was getting at,
he apologized. That's because you were not listening. It's a great failing of yours, Geryon.
Geryon flushed.
What happened the first time you found out you could, well, do things?
He asked, wanting to change the subject.
It was something silly, Wolf replied. Usually is, the first time.
What was it?
Wolf shrugged.
I wanted to move a big rock. My arms and back were not strong enough, but my mind was. After that, I didn't have any choice but to learn to live with it, because once you unlock it, it is unlocked forever. That's the point where your life changes, and you have to start learning to control yourself.
It always gets back to that, doesn't it?
Always. It's not as difficult as it sounds, really. Look at Mandaralan.
He pointed at the knight, who was riding with Durnik. The two of them were deep in discussion.
Now, Mandaralan's a nice enough fellow, honest, sincere, toweringly noble. But let's be honest. His mind has never been violated by an original thought. Until now. He is learning to control fear, and learning to control it is forcing him to think. Probably for the first time in his whole life. It is painful for him, but he is doing it. If Mandaralan can learn to control fear with that limited brain of his, surely you can learn the same kind of control over the other emotions. After all, you are quite a bit brighter than he is.
Silk, who had been scouting ahead, came riding back to join them.
Belgarath, there is something about a mile in front of us that I think you had better take a look at.
All right. Wolf replied. Think about what I've been saying, Geryon. We will talk more about it later.
Then he and Silk moved off through the trees at a gallop. Geryon pondered what the old man had told him. The one thing that bothered him the most was the crushing responsibility his unwanted talent placed upon him. The colt frisked along beside him, galloping off into the trees from time to time and then rushing back, his little hooves pattering on the damp ground. Frequently he would stop and stare at Geryon, his eyes full of love and trust.
"Oh, stop that,"
Geryon told him. The colt scampered away again. Princess Zenedra moved her horse up until she was beside Geryon.
"What were you and Belgarath talking about?"
Geryon shrugged.
"A lot of things."
There was immediately a hard little tightening around her eyes. In the months that they had known each other, Geryon had learned to catch those minute danger signals. Something warned him that the princess was spoiling for an argument. And with an insight that surprised him, he reasoned out the source of her unspoken belligerence. What had happened in the cave had shaken her badly, and Zenedra did not like to be shaken. To make matters even worse, the princess had made a few coaxing overtures to the colt, obviously wanting to turn the little animal into her personal pet. The colt, however, ignored her completely, fixing all of his attention on Geryon, even to the point of ignoring his own mother, unless he was hungry. Tenedra disliked being ignored even more than she disliked being shaken. Glumly, Geryon realized how small were his chances of avoiding a squabble with her.
"I certainly wouldn't want to pry into a private conversation," she said tartly. "Oh, it wasn't private. We were talking about sorcery and how to keep accidents from happening. I don't want to make any more mistakes."
She turned that over in her mind, looking for something offensive in it. His mild answer seemed to irritate her all the more.
"I do not believe in sorcery," she said flatly.
In the light of all that had recently happened, her declaration was patently absurd, and she seemed to realize that as soon as she said it. Her eyes hardened even more. Geryon sighed.
"All right," he said with resignation. "Was there anything in particular you wanted to fight about, or did you just want to start yowling and sort of make it up as we go along?"
"Yowling?"
Her voice went up several octaves.
"Yowling?"
"Screeching, maybe," he suggested, as insultingly as possible. As long as the fight was inevitable anyway, he determined to get in a few digs at her before her voice rose to the point where she could no longer hear him.
"Screeching?"
she screeched. The fight lasted for about a quarter of an hour before Barak and Aunt Paul moved forward to separate them. On the whole, it was not very satisfactory. Geryon was a bit preoccupied, too much so to put his heart into the insults he flung at the tiny girl, and Zenedra's irritation robbed her retorts of their usual fine edge. Toward the end, the whole thing had degenerated into a tedious repetition of "spoiled brat,"
"stupid peasant,"
echoing endlessly back from the surrounding mountains. Mr. Wolf and Silk rode back to join them.
"What was all of that yelling about?"
"The children were playing,"
Aunt Paul replied, with a withering look at Geryon.
"Where's Hetar?"
Silk asked.
"Right behind us," Varak said.
He turned to look back toward the pack horses, but the tall Algar was nowhere to be seen. Barak frowned.
"He was just there. Maybe he stopped for a moment to rest his horse or something."
"Without saying anything?
Oh, that's not like him. And it's not like him to leave the pack horses unattended." "He must have had some good reason," Dernek said. "I'll go back and look for him."
"No," Mr. Wolf told Barak. "Wait a few minutes. Let's not get scattered all over these mountains. If anybody goes back, we all go back." They waited. The wind stirred the branches of the pines around them, making a mournful sighing sound. After several moments, Aunt Paul let out her breath almost explosively.
"He's coming."
There was a steely note in her voice.
"He's been entertaining himself."
From far back up the trail, Hetar appeared in his black leather clothing, riding easily at a loping canter with his long scalp lock flowing in the wind. He was leading two saddled but riderless horses. As he drew nearer, they could hear him whistling rather tunelessly to himself.
"What have you been doing?" Barak demanded.
"There were a couple of Murkos following us,"
Hetar replied, as if that explained everything.
"You might have asked me to go along,"
Barak said, sounding a little injured. Hetar shrugged.
"There were only two. They were riding Algar horses, so I took it rather personally."
"It seems that you are always finding some reason to take it personally where Murgos are concerned,"
Aunt Paul said crisply.
"Yes, it does seem to work out that way, doesn't it?"
"Didn't it occur to you to let us know where you were going?"
"There were only two. I did not expect to be gone for very long."
She drew in a deep breath, her eyes flashing dangerously.
"Let it go, Paul,"
Mr. Wolf told her.
"But
you're not going to change him, so why excite yourself about it? Besides, it is just as well to discourage pursuit.
The old man turned to Hetar, ignoring the dangerous look Aunt Paul leveled at him.
Were the Murgos some of those who were with Brill?
Hetar shook his head.
No. Brill's Murgos were from the south, and they were riding Murgo horses. These two were northern Murgos.
Is there a visible difference?
Mandarallan asked curiously.
Their armor is slightly different, and the southerners have flatter faces. They are not quite so tall.
Where did they get Algar horses?
They are herd raiders,
Hetar answered bleakly.
Algar horses are valuable in Tol Murgos, and certain Murgos make a practice of creeping down into Algeria on horse-stealing expeditions. We try to discourage that as much as possible.
Oh, these horses aren't in very good shape,
Durnik observed, looking at the two weary-looking animals that Hetar was leading.
They've been ridden hard. Whip cuts all over them.
Hetar nodded grimly.
That is another reason to hate the Murgos.
Did you bury them?
No. I left them, where any other Murgo who might be following can find them. I thought it might help to educate any who come along later.
There are some signs that others have been through here, too. I found the tracks of a dozen or so up ahead, Sulk told them.
It was to be expected, I suppose,
Mr. Wolf commented, scratching at his beard.
Tutchik's got his Grolems out in force. Tar Urgus is probably having the region patrolled. I'm sure they'd like to stop us if they could. I think we should move on down into the Vale as fast as possible. Once we are there, we won't be bothered any more. Don't they follow us down into the Vale, then?
Durnik asked, looking around nervously.
No. Murgos won't go into the Vale. Not for any reason. Aldur's spirit is there, and the Murgos are desperately afraid of him.
How many days to the Vale?
4, maybe 5, if we ride hard.
We had better get started then, said Silk.
Chapter 10 The weather, which had seemed on the brink of winter in the high mountains, softened back into autumn as they rode down from the peaks and ridges. The forest in the hills above Maragor had been thick with fir and spruce and heavy undergrowth. On this side, however, the dominant tree was the pine, and the undergrowth was sparse. The air seemed drier, and the hillsides were covered with high yellow grass. They passed through an area where the leaves on the scattered bushes were bright red. Then, as they moved lower, the foliage turned first yellow, then green again. Geryon found this reversal of the seasons strange. It seemed to violate all of his perceptions of the natural order of things. By the time they reached the foothills above the Vale of Aldur, it was late summer again, golden and slightly dusty. Although they frequently saw evidences of the Murgo patrols which were crisscrossing the region, they had no further encounters. After they crossed a certain undefined line, there were no more tracks of Murgo horses. They rode down beside a turbulent stream which plunged over smooth, rounded rocks, frothing and roaring. The stream was one of several forming the headwaters of the Aldur River, a broad flow running through the vast Algerian plain to empty into the Gulf of Kerik, 800 leagues to the northwest. The Vale of Aldur was a valley lying in the embrace of the two mountain ranges which formed the central spine of the continent. It was lush and green, covered with high grass and dotted here and there with huge solitary trees. Deer and wild horses grazed there, as tame as cattle. Skylarks wheeled and dove, filling the air with their song. As the party rode out into the valley, Geryon noticed that the birds seemed to gather wherever Aunt Paul moved, and many of the braver ones even settled on her shoulders, warbling and trilling to her in welcome and adoration.
I had forgotten about that, Mr. Wolf said to Geryon. It's going to be difficult to get her attention for the next few days.
Oh?
Every bird in the Vale is going to stop by to visit her. Happens every time we come here. The birds go wild at the sight of her.
Out of the welter of confused bird sound, it seemed to Geryon that, faintly, almost like a murmuring whisper, he could hear a chorus of chirping voices repeating, "Polgara, Polgara, Polgara."
Is it my imagination, or are they actually talking?
I'm surprised you haven't heard them before, Wolf replied. Every bird we've passed for the last 10 leagues has been babbling her name.
Look at me, Polgara, look at me,
a swallow seemed to say, hurling himself into a wild series of swooping dives around her head. She smiled gently at him, and he redoubled his efforts.
I've never heard them talk before.
They talk to her all the time. Sometimes they go on for hours. That's why she seems a little abstracted sometimes. She's listening to the birds. Your aunt moves through a world filled with conversation.
I didn't know that.
Well, not many people do.
The colt, who had been trotting rather sedately along behind Geryon, as they had come down out of the foothills, went wild with delight when he reached the lush grass of the vale. With an amazing burst of speed, he ran out over the meadows. He rolled in the grass, his thin legs flailing. He galloped in long, curving sweeps over the low rolling hills. He deliberately ran at herds of grazing deer, startling them into flight and then plunging along after them.
"Come back here!"
Geryon shouted at him.
"He won't hear you,"
Hetar said, smiling at the little horse's antics.
"At least he will pretend that he doesn't. He's having too much fun."
"Get back here right now!"
Geryon projected the thought a bit more firmly than he had intended. The colt's forelegs stiffened, and he slid to a stop. Then he turned and trotted obediently back to Geryon, his eyes apologetic.
"Bad horse,"
Geryon chided. The colt hung his head.
"Don't scold him," Wolf said. "You were very young once yourself."
Geryon immediately regretted what he had said and reached down to pat the little animal's shoulder.
"It's all right,"
he apologized. The colt looked at him gratefully and began to frisk through the grass again, although staying close. Princess Tenedra had been watching him. She always seemed to be watching him for some reason. She would look at him, her eyes speculative, and a tendril of her coppery hair coiled about one finger and raised absently to her teeth. It seemed to Geryon that every time he turned around she was watching and nibbling. For some reason he could not quite put his finger on. It made him very nervous.
"If he were mine, I would not be so cruel to him," she accused, taking the tip of the curl from between her teeth.
Geryon chose not to answer that. As they rode down the valley, they passed 3 ruined towers, standing some distance apart, and all showing signs of great antiquity. Each of them appeared to have originally been about 60 feet high, though weather and the passage of years had eroded them down considerably. The last of the 3 looked as if it had been blackened by some intensely hot fire.
"Was there some kind of war here, Grandfather?"
"No," Wolf replied rather sadly. "The towers belong to my brothers. That one over there was Belisambar's, and the one near it was Belmekor's. They died a long time ago."
"I didn't think sorcerers ever died."
"They grew tired. Or maybe they lost hope. They caused themselves no longer to exist."
"They killed themselves?"
"In a manner of speaking. It was a little more complete than that, though."
Geryon did not press it, since the old man appeared to prefer not to go into the details.
"What about the other one? The one that's been burned? Whose tower was that?"
"Belzedar's."
"Did you and the other sorcerers burn it after he went over to Torak?"
"No. He burned it himself. I suppose he thought that was a way to show us that he was no longer a member of our brotherhood. Belzedar always liked dramatic gestures."
"Where is your tower?"
Farther on down the vale."
"Will you show it to me?"
"If you like."
"Does Aunt Paul have her own tower?"
No. She stayed with me while she was growing up, and then we went out into the world. We never got around to building her one of her own.
They rode until late afternoon, and stopped for the day beneath an enormous tree which stood alone in the center of a broad meadow. The tree quite literally shaded whole acres,